Hey there, freedom fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And you're about to meet an entrepreneur whose success I'm just amazed and inspired by. But I have to admit, I don't understand. How did he do it? Garrett G created a simple app that got millions of downloads and millions of dollars in funding. He's the creator of Scan. Scan is a simple iPhone and Android app that allows you to scan barcodes and QR codes. When you scan one of them, it'll show you relevant information. Like if you scan a QR code, his app will show you the website maybe that it points to. If you scan a barcode, it'll show you how to buy the product that the barcode is associated with. I want to find out how this simple little app became such a big business. And I'm going to do this all thanks to Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. He is the startup's lawyer. I'll tell you more about him later. If you want to browse ahead, go to walkercorporatelaw.com. But for now, Garrett, thanks for doing the interview.
Yeah, of course. Excited to be chatting.
Does it make you feel uncomfortable when I talk like this, where I say, I don't understand how this simple ad got so many downloads?
No, to be honest, it's something I hear quite a bit. And it's, on the one hand, like, I'm confident in myself, I'm confident in my team, and we've always had big ambitions. But just to be transparent with you, this is my personal first go at a startup. So for me, it's also kind of every day brings new surprises that were a surprise to myself.
How much money did you raise?
To date, we've raised about 8.7. We did a seed round of 1.7 million about a year into the business, and then about a year after that, not too long ago, we did a Series A of 7 million.
And how many downloads of the app?
Today, it's a little over 58 million. And that's across all platforms from iOS, Android, Windows devices, and then even on the Amazon Kindle.
Okay. Unbelievable. You said it's your first go. What were you doing just before this?
So I was in school at Brigham Young University, Provo, Utah. Mm-hmm. And I was, I guess you could say I was freelancing. I kind of feel weird saying that I was freelancing because technically I was doing design and development, mostly logos, branding, but then a lot of websites and mobile stuff for other people and was charging them for it. So in that sense, I was doing freelance, but really in my mind, I was just trying to build my own skill set so that I could eventually build my own ideas. And so to me, it was more training and then, so I could make money off it. I was freelancing.
You said you were charging for it.
Mm-hmm.
How much were you charging?
When I started, I charged what I thought was a lot because all my buddies and classmates were making $8-$10 an hour at their student jobs. And I was like, well, how cool will I be if I can make double that? So I started by charging $16 an hour. And, I would be building somebody's website, tell them I was charging $16 an hour. And they would basically treat me like a $16 an hour employee. They treated me very poorly. And almost just as an experiment, I started to charge more and more. And so the next client would ask me how much I charge, and I would tell them I charged $24. And then later, I would tell people I charged $60. And it was interesting because every time, even though my skills, I guess, were getting a little better and better, people treated me a lot more better. To the point where, then just to push my limits, I said, I charge $150 an hour. And people continually said, oh, wow, you must be pretty good. Like, we want to definitely work with you. And then it got to the point where at charging $150 an hour, I had more work than I could handle. Yet I kind of have, I guess what you call a yes man syndrome, where I have a hard time turning down opportunities. And so, anyways, I didn't know what to do. And I came up with a scheme. I'm just going to charge people so much money that they'll turn me down, and that way I don't have to say no to them. Anyway, so I started saying to people that I charged $300 an hour. And the reaction wasn't, oh, that's too expensive. The reaction was, wow, you must be very good. We definitely want to work with you. And so I did that for about a year until I felt like my skills were where they could be to pursue Scan and start working on my own thing.
Would somebody please tell Scott Edward Walker that my rates now are $30,000 per episode? Please.
You must be really good.
Actually, $50,000. Let's go even better.
Yeah, I never reached the top. I'm curious to see how far I could have played it, because it just got far enough to the point where I was like, you know what, I'm going to start working on my own thing.
Were you someone who even as a kid was entrepreneurial and kept trying different things and selling and enjoyed that process, or were you more of an artist?
Looking back, I was definitely entrepreneurial. I didn't know what the word or term entrepreneurial was. But yeah, I mean, especially just hearing like from my parents and older siblings, the many entrepreneurial stories that they'll tell me about myself. But as for myself, I always considered myself more of an artist or a craftsman over a businessman or entrepreneur.
What do you mean by artist or craftsman? How did that express itself when you were growing up?
It was kind of like I always put the craft or the product first, whatever it was that I was working on, and money just kind of seemed to come my way. Like, my older siblings would always make fun of me because I would be this like 8-year-old boy doing arts and crafts. In my mind, I was doing arts and crafts and then trying to sell them and trying to run whatever business. So in my mind, it was arts and crafts, but then they would see me and I would have like a wallet full of cash and they just didn't know where it came from, you know? So I had the ability to attract money. But in my mind, again, it was more about what I was doing, whatever, like...
Garrett, what were you doing differently? Because I see a lot of people who are doing arts and crafts and they don't get paid. I see a lot of people who are struggling to charge and they don't get paid. You were doing something different. What did you do that allowed you to get paid even at an early age?
I think one thing is confidence. Like, I'll see a lot of people, or I'll work with a lot of people who, in my opinion, are far more talented than I am, far more, whether it's artistic, whatever it is, and yet when I talk to them, they don't see it that way, and so they're scared to put their art out in the world, they're scared to charge for it, scared to ask people for money, and I don't know if you'd call it foolishness or confidence, whatever it is, but I never really felt that hesitation. I was always naive or confident enough to, you know, ask someone, hey, if you want my services or if you want this product, whatever it is, I want the big bucks. You know, even when one of the stories when I was little and having like rock sales in my neighborhood where little kids would come up to me and, you know, I was like 6 to 8 years old at the time and I was just selling rocks that were out of my backyard. They could find the exact same rocks in their backyard. But I was telling these kids, you know, you go home, you get your parents' wallet and you bring me back $20 if you want my best rock.
Interesting. And you just had the confidence, the guts to say that. The chutzpah.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it wasn't confidence. To me, it was just the way things are. But as I've met other people, I've kind of realized that kind of their lack of confidence. And a lot of times, I wish they could see the potential and the, you know, value that I see inside them that they just haven't seen yet.
Mm. What were your parents like?
So, complete opposites. From my mom's side, she's very glitz, glamour. She was the host of a travel TV show, traveling the world, you know, with her Louis Vuitton luggage, you know, very fancy when it comes to her lifestyle. So that was half my life growing up. The other half was the complete opposite end of things, where my dad is reenacting Civil War scenes. He's dressing up like a cowboy. He's living in the middle of nowhere in a one-bedroom restored pioneer cabin.
Wow.
Doesn't know how to work a microwave to a TV. You know, so complete opposite ends of the scale.
I'm guessing because you went to BU, you grew up Mormon too?
Correct, yeah.
Okay. And how did that influence you? I don't...
You mean from like a business perspective or...
In any way. I don't really talk much about faith here, but occasionally it comes up. And so I'm just curious.
I think just from a broader perspective, and I don't know if this is the case in every situation, but at least in my personal situation, my faith does instill in me a lot of confidence, and not so much, I don't know if I'd say confidence, but just kind of a knowledge of like who I am and what I stand for and what I want to achieve or what I'm capable of. And so that's kind of from a broad perspective, but then from kind of a more specific, and also especially with business. I mean, in the Mormon faith, when a young man turns 19, he has the option to go serve, do 2 years of service in an unknown place. You don't really know. You just volunteer, and if they if you volunteer, then they send you somewhere. And in my case, I got sent to a place called Vladivostok, Russia, the far eastern coast of Russia. Mm-hmm. And to try to learn the language in the freezing cold of eastern Russia, I mean, now I'm not really scared to talk to anybody, because if you can talk to a Russian, not even knowing very well their own language, you know, nothing really gets harder than that. And so ever since...
How many converts did you make when you went to that part of Russia?
So when you go out, half of it is just service, you know, helping people any way you can. We taught in a free English club for people who wanted to learn English. And then half of it is proselyting, sharing, you know, your beliefs, your faith. And people, I mean, you know, we interacted with hundreds of people every day. As far as Russians that I met, got to know, and invited to join the church, the Mormon church, while I was out there for 2 years, there were 12 families and individuals.
Oh, wow. That's a lot. Because I do a little bit of reading about Mormonism because I'm fascinated by it. And one of the things that I notice is it's a very the 2 years that you go away seems like a very inefficient way to spread the word and proselytize. But it seems like a very strong way to put confidence in the person who goes overseas, to instill the faith in the person who goes overseas, that yes, you're going to help other people, but it feels like you help yourself so much more, and then what you take with you afterwards is the biggest impact. I could be wrong, but I feel like one of those commercials that they run or some other campaign can do more than get 12 families.
Yeah, if I could get families, like I could get app downloads, I would have been a lot better missionary.
Right.
Right? No, and you're totally right. Sometimes it's almost like an internal struggle when you're a missionary, because when you're serving these people, it is very like internally rewarding and uplifting to serve these people. And you just hope that, you know, you want them to feel that same joy, because usually it's the giver that is feeling more joy than the person receiving the service. And so, yeah, you're definitely right. And as far as like efficient, it's really fun when you return from your mission to talk to your friends who also served around the world and see like what it was like in Santiago, Chile, what it was like in Korea, you know, because everybody's having a different experience based on where they were around the world.
So you come back and you discover this QR technology. And a lot of us noticed it, but you were fascinated by it in a different way. What did it make you start to think?
I mean, so people see me today like, oh, you're head of a software app company, like you must be very techie. And of course, like I've definitely become a lot more techie since starting the company. But if you were to see me fresh off the mission, I mean, my life revolved around dating and sports, right? And really like nothing more. So being non-techie, when I first came across the QR code, it was I got my first smartphone, scanned a QR code, and I thought it was like black magic. I thought it was one of the coolest things I had ever seen. How did that information on this printed material just get into my digital device? Like, that connection to me just blew my mind. Mm-hmm. So immediately, because it gave me that magical experience, I kind of had like a connection to this technology. So I hopped online and I started to research it. And as most people would see, QR codes kind of have a negative reputation, a negative connotation. And it was, in my opinion, it was not the technology. Like, the technology worked. From my artistic point of view or designer's point of view, it was the way people were building products. People were using QR codes in the wrong way because people were building and designing the products in a wrong way. So it kind of was like, in my mind, a Cinderella story, where I wanted to take this cool technology that had given me a magical experience, and I wanted to give it a fighting chance by designing a better website to create QR codes and design a better app to scan them. Like, that was the very simple beginning. It was just me wanting to stick up for this technology.
Okay. And did you have any sense of where the revenue would come from?
No. Again, like, just kind of my mindset. I believed if I could create something of value, it would pay off financially. That's kind of my experience in the past. But it wasn't my top goal or priority.
T-shirts were part of the original plan. How did T-shirts fit in with your vision?
I mean, so the first thing I was like, okay, how can I use these in my own life? So I created t-shirts, I screen printed QR codes on them that linked to my Facebook. They were just statically linked to my Facebook. It said, friend me on Facebook. And because I had never done it before, basically I made every mistake you could when it comes to using QR codes. I made the QR code too big because my Facebook URL at the time was so big. The QR code was very complicated and hard to scan. I made it too big on the t-shirt, so it was also hard to scan unless my posture was right perfect. Anyways, but looking back, it was awesome because immediately I found, you know, a ton of things that while building my own website, my own QR code generator, I could guide the user to help avoid those mistakes that I made.
I see. I always assume that with QR codes that there's only one way to design one of these QR codes for each link that it's connected to, but that's not true at all, right? You can do it in many different ways. In fact, on your site, on scan.me, if I create a QR code for my Facebook page, you even put the F in the center.
Exactly.
To signify that it's a Facebook page. So there's a lot of creativity, I see. And so when you were putting it on a t-shirt, you learned to simplify it. You learned what works and what doesn't when people try to scan it. And
exactly.
Were you building the app at the same time as the t-shirt?
No, at first I was just playing with like QR code technology as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of in the process. At first, I didn't want to build those products. At first, I just wanted to use the technology myself. And it was, again, not being techie myself, I was getting frustrated. Like, okay, the screen printer who was going to make these t-shirts for me needed the QR code or the design in vector format. Well, none of the generators at a time would generate my code in anything but a PNG or a JPEG. So I had to toss that PNG into Illustrator and one square by at a time create it myself. And so, you know, that was check one. If I create a generator, I'm going to make sure it's automatically, you know, delivers you a vector file. So I just played around with QR codes, but it was quite quickly that I decided, you know what, I'm just going to try to build this myself. And that's when the frustration came, because it really burdened me to have an idea in my mind and not be able to build it myself. And so immediately that's when I started to, I guess you could say, freelance, to try to teach myself how to code, as well as design in Photoshop, Illustrator, and whatnot.
I'm on your site right now, and I just created a QR code for Mixergy. How do I get to... Oh, I see. I have to log in order to download it in a vector format.
Correct, yeah.
Gotcha, okay. All right, I see where you're going with this. What's the next step then?
The next step for scan? So mm-hmm. It started as something very simple, but then when we saw, like, very quickly, we started to see adoption and growth.
And it's because you got together with people from BYU and you got them to be co-founders. Those are the we.
Correct, yeah. So
right.
I started working on it myself for a while, and then I met two guys on BYU campus, and they kind of had the reputation on campus as, like, they were the best of the best. And I was a freshman at the time. I think both of them were seniors. And you had, like, people would tell me, yeah, you can go to those guys for advice, but don't ever try to team up with them. Like, they're too busy. They're too far along. Like, they wouldn't team up with you. But as soon as somebody told me that, that basically, like, locked my sights on them. Like, yep, those are my guys. That's who I want to work with.
I see.
So I started a process of courting them and trying to woo them and persuade them.
How did you woo them?
I mean, not like directly. I don't even know if they knew what my intentions were, but I was everything from like simply taking them out to lunch and whatever. But then also like, hey, I just designed these business cards for you. Feel free to use them if you want. You know, hey, I saw that you're working on this site. Would you like me to design the logo for that site? Like anything I could do to develop like a personal relationship, but then also a working relationship so they could see my skills and my value.
Okay.
And then after, honestly, it was maybe, 5 to 8 months of that I finally said, hey, there's this project I'm working on, and I was wondering if you guys would like to. And immediately they're like, finally, you're asking us. We've been waiting for you.
Wow.
Let's do this.
And what do they bring to the business? What skills?
So they're both developers. My specialty would be in design, and they're both developers. From the early on days, Kirk, my one co-founder, was always working on the web side of things, and Ben was doing everything on the mobile side of things.
Okay. How does Kirk pronounce his last name? Is it Wemet?
Yeah, Wemet.
Wemet. And Ben Turley.
Correct.
All right. So you were saying, actually, why don't we continue from there? How long did it take you to build the first version of the site and the app?
I mean, when we started working on it, it wasn't too long. It was less than 6 months, maybe even closer to 3 months that it took before we launched version one of the website and the app. And I think it was within the same week that we launched those two products.
And you went iOS first?
Yep. We just had a simple website that did nothing but generate codes, and then the app was just on iOS, and it did nothing but scan QR codes.
That's it.
Yeah, nothing else. Might have had a history, but I don't even think it had a history yet.
How'd you get your first 12 users?
On the app, the first 12 users came when I saw, and like this goes to this being my first go at any sort of venture, mm-hmm. and I hope I never lose this. Like, luckily for me, it's still exciting every time we release any new feature or product. But man, when I saw our app in the App Store and downloaded it, that was like a magical, magical moment for me to see something that was in my mind and it was just a dream. And now it's live on my iPhone. Like, I couldn't believe it. So I took that excitement, and there was a party that night at on campus. And I was literally up on the table telling everybody at the party, like, you need to download my new app. I think I got about 12 people to download it that night. So I thought those were our first 12 users. I thought we were off to a great start, Getting 12 downloads our first night, and we were bound for glory. Anyways, we get together the next day, Ben Kirk and myself, and we got about 2,000 that first day.
So how do you get 2,000 so quickly?
So I think Apple does a really good job. Like, if you're a brand new app, they'll give you a little bit of, like, I don't know, like free exposure bump, whatever you want to call it, so that you at least have the chance to succeed. And it's my opinion that you need to be ready and you need to put your best foot forward, because you can either use that for better or for worse. Some companies will push out the app even though it's not quite ready, just so it can like simmer in the App Store, and then they're going to try to improve it. And to me, I think that's actually a mistake, because when Apple gives you that first little bit of help, you need to take advantage of that, you know, and get as many downloads as possible so that you can continue to ride that wave and make it into the new and noteworthy, and you can, you know, work your way up the rankings. Because if you immediately, in Apple's algorithms or however they do it, get branded as a, you know, who cares app, then it's really hard to work your way out of that hole.
And this, I don't think Apple does this anymore, but back then, they used to have for each category a what's new section that was constantly updated, right? And so it was top free, top paid, and what's new for each category. And that's where you rose up for utilities.
Yeah, and I think one key thing that we did very well from the beginning was understanding where our downloads would be coming from. Because mm-hmm. if you're a game or if you're a social app or something of the sort, you need to build in like that social aspect. You need to build in that virality into the app. And then you need to be highly ranked in order to be discovered. For us, we understood that most of our downloads would come when somebody out in the wild saw either a QR code or a barcode, wanted to scan that, and then would go to their smartphone searching for some sort of app that could scan it. And even though there were hundreds, I mean, there's a little over 300 apps in the App Store that did scanning when we launched our app, but they were called Red Laser, Shop Savvy, Enigma, Mikado, stuff like that. And nobody's going to see a QR code and off the top of their head decide, I'm going to search for Enigma. So, you know, we were fortunate enough to name our app Scan, and the business it was registered under was QR Code City. So whether people were searching barcode, QR code, or scan, we showed up above these people who had older and more popular apps than us. And so we knew our game, we knew what we were playing, you know, and we focused on that.
Could you put your Skype on Do Not Disturb, just so it doesn't make that noise when your friends come up? The way to do that is top left of your screen, go to the green bubble and select Do Not Disturb. While you're doing that, I'll show. This is what it looks like in the App Store right there.
There it is.
It's called right now Scan QR Code and Barcode Reader. And so that's one of the things that you did. The other thing I noticed is the icon like that. Is that part of the plan also to have an icon like that?
So the icon's been an interesting story. Initially, the icon looked more like it showed a QR code and a barcode, and it had a red laser scanning through it.
Mm-hmm.
And that at the time was unique. Nobody really had an icon that looked like that. And we basically wanted to teach the untrained user what the app did before they even read anything, and just immediately when they saw it. Unfortunately, there were a lot of apps that immediately, as we started to pick up in popularity, started to, like, to the T, copy our icon. And, you know, we were growing so quickly and doing so well, we really didn't mind. But once we started, I think it was just recently when we passed about 50 million downloads, that we wanted to diversify, really set ourselves apart as a brand. And that's when we switched to that more branded red icon for the paid app.
Mm-hmm. But the idea was always to give an icon that showed what the product does, not a logo, not an interesting design, but something that says very clearly, this is what we do.
Exactly. And some brands have done a very good job, with their unique names. Instagram, it doesn't really tell you what Instagram does, but it works for them as a brand. But if people come to me with advice, just my personal opinion is, if you're a new app and you're just starting from ground zero, a good strategy is to simply name your app whatever it does and design the icon to show exactly like what it does. That's a good beginning strategy that you can then try to build a brand off of as you grow in popularity.
Okay.
But for beginners, it really helped us.
All right, so what we're seeing is, yes, talking to your friends got you some users, but not very much. But
exactly.
Apple's original help, where it was highlighting you, gave you a push. Being very clear about what your product does and using the name that people search for, that helped get you even more traffic and more users.
Yeah.
I'm looking at an early version of your site. Before we continue with the story and understand how you got even more users, I'm looking at an early version of your site, and it's... Scan makes it, here's the tag, or the sentence here at the top. Scan makes it simple to create beautiful QR code experiences. What does that mean, beautiful QR code experiences? Did the app allow me to make QR codes or allow me to use the UR codes?
So speaking specifically about the website, when I mentioned that QR codes had a bad reputation and that people were using them poorly, like, a QR code is a QR code, but what a lot of people did as far as making mistakes, they would make it so when you scan the QR code, it just went to their homepage. Or even worse, if you scan the QR code, it went to non-mobile friendly content, like whatever it was. And in our opinion, like, a QR code should be treated like just an action button, like a call to action that is hopefully native, and in one tap, you can like gain value from that experience.
I see.
And so we were saying with that tagline, like, not only are we going to give you a QR code that works at its best, but we're going to also help you develop or create the experience behind the QR code that'll bring the user as much value as quickly as possible.
Okay. All right. So now we're 2,000 users. What do you do to get the next group of users?
So we, being poor college students,
mm-hmm.
And we had this growing app, we had a lot of opportunities. We had a lot of people reach out to us saying, hey, we saw that you have a quickly growing app. You know, we market apps, you put in this much money and we'll guarantee you this many downloads. You know, some were all right, some were really good. You know, like, if you put in $5,000 in this week, we will get you 10,000 downloads. But we just couldn't afford it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So in our opinion, our only option was to try to create something so valuable and so impressive that it would market itself. Then hopefully one day as we made more money off it, then we could do some marketing. Anyways, the app continued to grow and grow, you know, from 2,000 downloads a day to 4 to 5 to, you know, 10,000 downloads a day. And then it started getting picked up by a lot of blogs, you know, calling it the faster of all the QR code scanners. If anytime anybody said, you know, here's the best utility apps that you should have, or if you need a QR code scanner, this is the one to pick. But none of those were paid features. They just, you know, kind of came about organically. And it continued to grow that way on its own till we passed 83,000 downloads a day. And I just remember that number specifically because in my math, there's a little over 83,000 seconds in a day. And so I put that number marker in my mind, waiting for the day when we are getting more than one download a second.
And so you hit 83 from the name, from the logo that you had at the time, and from blogs starting to pick it up. Did you do anything? I know later on you had a PR person, but early on, did you do anything to get all these blogs to write about you?
No, not early on. We probably went even a few months and definitely passed our first 1,000,000 downloads before I reached out to any sort of bloggers.
We talked about the benefit of having a name like Scan. When someone types in Scan QR, you guys come up much more naturally than Red Laser, for example, might. What about the downside, which is, for me, when I was searching for your company, I couldn't type Scan into the search, into Google. I had to type in Scan and your name, for example, to find any articles about the company.
Yeah, and I mean, that's just kind of like, you know, pros and cons to anything, and that was something we're willing to like fight that uphill battle because, yeah, definitely hard to take a word as generic as Scan, especially since it's like legally not trademarkable. Mm-hmm. But how sweet will it be if something as generic as Scan is, you know, branded well enough that we own, you know, that word in the future? So we're definitely not there yet, but that'll be pretty awesome if we can get there.
So I'll talk a little bit about Scott Edward Walker, walkercorporatelaw.com is a site. In fact, instead of me talking about him, do you have any advice for other entrepreneurs about how to pick a lawyer or about when to pick a lawyer?
So I'm pretty biased on this topic mm-hmm. where I think because there's so many failures in the startup world and because it's so easy to get distracted or spend a lot of money mm-hmm. on the legal side of things, I think you just need to push as far ahead and kind of get as far as along as you can. And it'll kind of come about naturally and organically. At least that was the case for us, where we had built the app, we started meeting with investors, we were like days away from closing our funding when we first started working with lawyers on our side.
Okay.
Because of that, you know, we were able to immediately hook up with some really top-notch lawyers that we wouldn't have been able to otherwise because we were far enough along.
I see. All right. And so it sounds like you're happy with that process and you'd recommend it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the only thing I've experienced. We've only done this one time and that's how it panned out and we've been really happy.
Okay.
With our lawyers, and you know, they continually save us and you know, advise us.
What do you mean? How have they saved you?
Oh, just from like silly mistakes. I don't even know if I can say anything off the top of my head, but but there's been multiple times where like, oh no, you don't want to do that. You know, just simple rookie mistakes that first timers are bound to make every day.
All right, let me just do the app real quick here. This is what it looks like on my phone. Oh, dude, did you see how fast that went? And it took directly. That's the thing I like about it, actually. Let me do it one more time. Let's see if I can actually hide.
Slow it up.
I'm going to hide the QR code on my screen with my hand. So now you can see right underneath there is my... This is you somewhere on the screen, right underneath here.
Yeah.
And then it went. So it is. It's really quick.
Yeah.
All right. So let's continue then with how you got more users. What's the next step? What allowed you to, I guess it was going to bloggers directly was the next step for getting traffic, right? For getting downloads.
Mm-hmm. And when you mentioned we worked with a PR team.
And
yes. We've done that once upon a time for about a week. We tried that. And I think highly of PR people, I think highly of that PR group, but again, it was not for me personally because what I learned was I had more confidence than the PR people I was working with. And when I said, hey, we're going to announce our seed round of funding and I want to be in this publication with this writer and this publication with this writer, they're like, oh, yeah, those are the top dogs. Like, you're not worthy of that yet. Wait off, hold off a little bit and you know, maybe someday in the future you can write with them, but for now, these are who you should go after. And to me, I was like, well, why shouldn't we go for the best? Like, it just didn't make sense to me. And so anyways, I ended up disobeying them, kind of working outside of help and getting those people who I wanted and getting, you know, in my mind, like the biggest publications from my favorite writers. And anyways, so that was the last time we worked with a PR group. And ever since then, I've just done it myself.
I was just searching our internal database to see how we discovered you, to see if maybe your PR firm happened to contact us or you. But no, it's Alex Champagne, who was searching around for interesting entrepreneurs who've gone far and did something that other entrepreneurs want to learn from, and came across your name on October 2nd. So the PR firm, one of the things that you wanted, I know, was to get into TechCrunch. It seems like a natural to get into TechCrunch, isn't it? If you've built an app that got a million downloads, wasn't that enough?
Yeah, I mean, this was me, this being my first go and me not knowing really anything about the tech space. When I started hearing from investors, and I didn't know what an investor was, I didn't know how to work with investors, and somebody had told me, well, if there's this blog called TechCrunch, and if you read TechCrunch, you'll read about other companies that got funded, for how much, what they're doing, and basically just learn the gist of the ecosystem in this space. So I started reading TechCrunch, and there was one writer, Alexia, who I kind of connected with better, everything she would write. And so for me, I kind of saw her like as one of my mentors, even though she didn't know I existed, to help teach me about this space, being a very novice beginner. Anyways, and so it almost became a personal dream and mission for me, like how cool will it be if I create a company, an app, or do anything worthy of Alexia writing a story and it going in TechCrunch. Like that to me was going to be awesome, you know. So when the PR team started working with us, and I was like, oh sweet, it's the, you know, PR time, I want to be in TechCrunch and I want Alexia to write my story.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, she just got promoted, so that's probably not going to happen, but how about these people? And I was like, I don't know who those people are, I want Alexia. So that's when that began.
And did you get her?
So I remember it was the day before our story was supposed to go live. The story was going to go live at midnight. Mm-hmm. And I had an interview lined up with Sarah Perez. And nothing against Sarah Perez, I had never met her, but I just wanted Alexia to write my story.
That was a dream. You built this thing up with a vision. Yes.
The PR group had lined up the interview with Sarah Perez. And I'm like, look, I realize you put a lot of effort to this. I'm sorry, but I want to cancel on Sarah so I can do an interview with Alexia. And they're like, oh, that's a huge mistake. You hired us to advise you, and we are advising you, do not cancel on Sarah. And I was like, you know, let me think about it. And I called them right back, and I said, look, at the end of this day, I'm either going to write about this in my journal or I'm not. And I'm going to be pretty let down if I don't get Alexia writing about this, and I'm not going to want to record this day in my journal. So if this all goes to pot, I will take, you know, the bad, like my bad. But I'm not going to let this go to pot. Just trust me on this one. Anyways, I could tell how much, I felt bad. I could tell how stressful it was for them because we had hired them. Anyways, we canceled on her. It was like 3 p.m. Then it was 4 p.m. Everybody was just stressing out in the office. And finally, because I had been pestering her through email, Facebook, Twitter, whatever, Alexia finally messaged me on Facebook and said, if you have 5 minutes and you can get down to the TechCrunch office in 10 minutes, because one of my demands was I also wanted the interview in person. she said, then I will interview you. So I burst out of our San Francisco office as soon as I saw that message, hopped on my bike, and was yelling at Suri, like, where's the TechCrunch office? Take me to their office. And, you know, it was just running red lights, got to the TechCrunch office, just in enough time to find Alexia finishing up one of the stories she was working on. And I don't know like what inspired me to do this, but as soon as she was like, okay, tell me more about your company, tell me what you're here for, immediately I kind of felt inspired to not talk about my business, not talk about my story, not talk about my funding, but to kind of ask her a few questions and kind of make that short time that I had with her one-on-one mm-hmm. more about her. And anyways, I basically just told her how much I had learned from her, how much I appreciated her writing, and really what she had done, how it had affected and influenced my personal life. And anyways, we talked about that for maybe 15 minutes and talked about her for about 15 minutes. And then we left and she's like, hey, you know, really enjoyed chatting with you. If you want me to write a story about your company, I'd be happy to. Just call me later tonight.
Oh, wow.
And it was cool. Like, I went back and told the PR team, and they thought I was lying. And they thought Alexia was lying and that she would never write the story about us. But I was confident. Like, I thought it would happen. And sure enough, like, an hour before midnight, she calls me. We have about an hour discussion. And then the story went live 1 minute before midnight about our funding on TechCrunch, written by Alexia.
I'm looking at the article that you wrote. Look at the first sentence, though. The most impressive thing about Scan is that it, as a humble QR code app, has raised over $1.7 million. So she's basically saying it's impressive that this little app got so much. And you're not bothered by that.
And she did. I mean, I know who we are. Like, I realize our uphill battle. I realize, like, all the negative things that people could say about our business, true and untrue. And we realize that, but we also know what we're working towards and what we want to accomplish. Anyways, and so when Alexia put out that story, and it was basically exactly how I wanted it crafted. It included a video. Mm-hmm. It included a lot of images, which most, you know.
A lot of images.
So I, just being a designer, I wanted a lot of images in it. When she tweeted about it, she tweeted it from TechCrunch's account, but then also her personal account, you know. So anyways, and then came the haters, where everybody is like, why the heck is Alexia writing about this startup? Why is she writing about a seed round? Why is she writing about a stupid QR code product, you know? And that's when I knew we had done our job. When the haters come, you've done a good
job.
I mean, anything, you know, whether people love you or hate you, if somebody's that passionate about it, you're doing something right.
Yeah, I'm looking at the haters right here. one person, I guess the CEO of mobileads.com, in the comments on that original TechCrunch article said, just wondering, what is the revenue model for scan.me? At the time, there was no revenue. You were giving away the app for free. The app that I just showed everyone cost me, what, $3 or so? At the time, it was for free. What was the revenue model at the time?
At the time? So the history of the revenue model is this.
Yep.
I remember when our app first went live, and my co-founder, Kirk, who's definitely more, I don't want to say money-driven, but money-minded and money-savvy more than I am, said, hey, let's set some goals. You know, maybe by the end of this year, we could have 1 million downloads and make $5,000. And I was like, well, that's not going to be like my personal motivation, but I'm not one to shoot down dreams. So I'm confident we could somehow make $5,000 off this app and get 1 million downloads. Anyways, we got the first 1 million downloads in about 3 months. But, you know, wanting to somehow make $5,000 turned into raising $1.7 million. And our investors that we raised that seed round from were, you know, smart enough themselves that they would ask me. They would straight up ask me in the pitches in the meetings, like, how do you plan to make money? And with most of them, my honest answer was, well, you can see the potential behind this. I don't need to, like, try to fool you with whatever financial projections. You're smart enough to see the potential behind what we're doing financially.
Because but you had no answer. You were...
Yeah. I mean, we see potential in it, you know, and we saw potential in it at that time. But that basically puts the ball in the investor's court. Like, are you smart enough to see how this product can make money?
Charles River Ventures, they let you get away with that as an answer? They did.
Yeah. Okay. And this was the thing. Like, when we raised money, I had a bad, like, people had told me a lot of negative things about investors and basically told me I should never work with them. And I was like, well, let me go form my own opinion about them, but I am going to be careful. Knowing how my mind works, if somebody only wants to invest in us because of our financial projections and our market research and whatever hubbub numbers, you know, made up numbers, then I don't really want to work with them. Because if somebody likes me for my numbers in any business, successful or not, are going to go up and down. And I didn't want their emotions or their feelings about me to go up and down with my numbers. So if I make the pitch totally about my team and my vision, then they're going to be in this for the long run if they like me. And of course, that turned away a lot of investors. You know, people think it's cool because we raised a lot of money from very high quality investors. But what they don't see are the 48 investors that laughed me out of their office because I didn't have any financial projections for them.
What do you say to someone who's listening here and says, this guy just lucked out. It all happened so easily. I don't see any challenges. He wants something, he just gets it, but it's not making an effort, really. He got 1 million downloads in months. That's not possible. What do you say about that?
I mean, are we lucky? No. Are we blessed? Yes. Are we working our tails off? Yes, we're working as hard as we possibly can. When I see and I talk to other startups or other founders trying to raise money or basically duplicate what we've done, I realized how fortunate and blessed we are. But again, like, you know, people only see the positive for the most part. People see the 12 investors that, you know, invested in our seed round. They see all the positive stuff coming out.
What don't they see then?
But what they don't see is, you know, I was taking 10 meetings a day for 3 weeks or so, and that equals a lot more than 12 investors. And so I had to go through a lot of people saying no, saying that I wasn't good enough, that my company wasn't good enough, that QR codes are dead. And, you know, every time it hurt, you know. As confident as I am, anytime you have an investor that knows the space better than you and says, no, this is not going to make it, you know, that hurts. And it's really hard to then suck it up, put on a good face again because you've got a meeting in 10 minutes. And to do that, you know, time after time. But
what didn't
they
get, these people who, when you talk to them and with all their experience, they said QR codes are dead. Mark Cuban said that to you, and we'll get to that in a moment. What were they all missing that you understood, that Google Ventures understood, that CRV understood when they invested?
I would say, I think it's me and my team. If somebody says no to QR code or whatever idea, you know, a lot of people can make up whatever excuse that they don't want to invest or work with you. But in my opinion, it's all about the person. It's all about the individual or the team. And so I would say, you know, Google said yes. And maybe they like QR codes, maybe they don't, but they saw the potential in me and my team and how QR codes are going to die. That doesn't matter. Like Gary and his team, they're going to do whatever necessary to make their company a success. Because they like us, they were willing to work with us. And so that's why I think I did take it so personal when people would say no, because I'm like, look, I don't even hear whatever excuse you're making. I understand that you just don't want to work with me.
How did you meet Mark Cuban and have him tell you publicly QR codes are dead?
Mark Cuban and I met for our first time on the ABC TV show Shark Tank.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that was the first time we had met, and it was I haven't talked to him since.
And so why go on Shark Tank?
When the opportunity came to be on Shark Tank and kind of pursue and that option, I remember we reached out to our investors and said, hey, we're considering going on this TV show. I'm sure you've seen it, heard of it, whatever. And it was interesting. It was about 50-50 split of our investors being like, yeah, sounds cool. Good luck to you trying to get on the show. And then the other half of the investors being like, no, there's so many unknown as far as what it could do to your reputation. It could, they edit it however they want to. You never know how it's going to turn out. Anyways, being the yes man that I am, part of it was I wanted the experience. Like, how fun to have the opportunity to be on primetime television, you know? Wanted to take advantage of that opportunity. And then the other was I had confidence that, look, they can edit it however they want, but if I represent myself and the company well enough, it should come out, positively. And so we didn't need, from a cash point of view, we didn't need the investment of the sharks. We had just raised our $7 million Series A. However, I did research each of the investors or sharks and see the other added value they could bring into the company, and definitely wanted to work with any single one of them going into the show.
I'm looking here on this screen. Jason Del Rey wrote an article for All Things D about what the value of being on Shark Tank is for an app maker. And for you, what was that big value?
One of the bigger results of it was it immediately bumped us into the number one spot in paid utilities.
Mm-hmm. That's what he said, that was huge for you guys just on that level alone. Did Shark Tank take a piece of your business because you went on the show?
No, I'm not sure the specifics on this, but as far as I understand, Shark Tank used to, in previous seasons, take a percentage of every company, whether they did a deal or not. In the fifth season, the season I participated in, they made it clear beforehand that had been done away with, and there's basically no risk at coming on this show.
Kevin O'Leary said he was apparently underwhelmed by the startup's 50 million app downloads because it was free and there was no revenue with it.
Mm-hmm.
You started charging. At the time that this post went up on All Things D, it was $1.99. When I bought it, it was $2.99. What made you decide to start charging for your app instead of continuing and maybe running ads or something?
So we've always wanted to, like, I personally respect an app that is a paid app more than a free app. Like, I just think more people make such quality things, like, they need to benefit from it. And then on the other hand, like, people need to be more willing to pay for quality things. And so just understanding that there's definitely two mindsets in the world. The idea wasn't, let's just make our app paid and nothing more. The idea was, let's make the best app possible, make it paid, but then also have a free version of lesser quality that is just for the other half of the world, the other mindset, you could say.
I'm looking to see how the free app is doing. It's not competing as strongly with other apps, is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's brand new. I mean, what, it's maybe a month old now.
Oh, I see. Okay. So you started charging for the existing one, and then you created a different version that now had to fight in the App Store.
So the one that's currently paid is our older existing app.
Gotcha.
And that was the scary thing. Like, when we were, you know, a top app, we were always top 10, you know, bouncing between 1 and 10 in our category for the free section. And it was scary knowing when we switched that to paid, it would totally drop off the charts and, you know, not be seen. But going back to what I said earlier, we understood that our game wasn't a game of ranking high. Our game was a game of discoverability, and we weren't going to, you know, hurt anything on discoverability when somebody would search for an app similar to ours. And then, luckily, it wasn't long before we made the switch to paid that we were on Shark Tank and bumped back up into the high ranking.
You raised, after the 1.7 that we talked about, you raised another $7 million. We'll talk about one of the reasons why I think you were able to raise so much, but here's the rumor, I think, that's out there. You took some money off the table.
Meaning?
You were able to put some of that money in your pocket and some in the company's pocket so that you have some personal safety, financial safety.
Uh-huh. So you're saying when we raised this Series A of $7 million?
Yes.
So I'm sorry, I'm not fully understanding this. So when we raised the...
Did any of that money go to you in exchange for your shares? Did any of that money go directly to you, or did it all go to the company?
So, okay, yeah, I'm getting you better now. So when we raised Series A, the lead investor who came in wanted to own as much as the company as possible. Mm-hmm. So they offered not only us founders, but every existing investor from the seed round, mm-hmm, saying, hey, we want to buy up as much equity as possible at this price. Who's willing to sell? Anyways, to my surprise, I thought, like, wow, investors who believed in us at the seed round stage now have the opportunity to make like a 3x return on their investment. Like, to me, being rookie, I just thought that was awesome. I was like, yeah, who's going to take it? anyway, and nobody did. Everybody, you know, is pretty confident saying, hey, we like what you're doing. We're confident that you're going to be a lot bigger than you are currently. We would like to keep our ownership in your company. And then for us founders, they made the same deal, like, hey, we want to buy up as much equity as you're willing to give up. And they gave us a range of options. And all three of us said, hey, whatever we do, let's do it together for the same amount. And so we did just a very small chunk, sell equity in return for cash.
That's what I meant. Okay. Did it give you any personal safety? Do you feel more comfortable now?
We all three of us co-founders are young enough that we don't really need a lot of money to to live comfortable.
I know. I see the shoes you went on Shark Tank with. That's not going to cost a ton of money.
Those are not expensive. And the fact that I wear them every day. Yeah, not tough. But yeah, But it did. Like, I would sound probably ungrateful if I didn't say that, yeah, that money definitely changed our lives, influenced our lives, and, you know, added security. And that's another thing. When I talk about confidence and I meet other founders, I'm like, look, you, like, you're worth a lot more than you're treating yourself. You know, your life can be better. Your life can be easier. It's not about all about taking risks. The risk should be like changing the world or not, not whether or not you can be able to put food on your table.
See,
so
yeah.
Pay yourself enough that you don't have to think about that, so that all of your efforts and brain power can go towards changing the world.
So far, I've talked a lot about you, a little bit about your co-founders, but there's a whole team behind Scan. One day, though, in order to get to here, you had to experience this thing where one day you walked into the office and you just weren't excited. And that helped us get to where we are today. Why weren't you excited that day?
I remember I walked into the office and somebody was like, oh, I'm so glad you're here. I think I had been out for the weekend or something like mm-hmm. that. And we were working all day, every day. And so I had been gone maybe 2 or 3 days. I came back to the office and somebody said, I'm so glad you're back. Everybody works so much harder when you're around.
Mm.
And I'm sure they just meant that as a compliment. But to me, that was just heartbreaking. I'm like, no, tell me I didn't, you know, hire people that work harder only if I'm around, you know, tell me I didn't hire people that are employees or see this as a job. And that's kind of when it hit me. So I got together with my co-founders and said, look, what do you guys think? Is this a problem? And we realized, like, we were building a business. We had hired, I think we were between 12 to 16 people, if you include contractors, really great people, really great employees. But we realized, like, we felt like we were coming out of startup mode too early. And we still needed to build our founding team. We still needed people of founder quality or founder mindsets. And so what we did is we basically made a list of who in this company requires a manager, requires a boss, something of the sort. And unfortunately, like, every single person on that list, although they were great employees, needed some sort of boss. And I, being the head of the company, I feel personally responsible for this, that I had to let go of those people, because if I were a better boss or if I were a manager, it would still be with the company because of how great they were. But because I wasn't there personally and because the company wasn't quite ready for that stage, we ended up letting go of every single person but one person. So we went from a company of 12 to 16 to a company of 3 co-founders plus one other. So we're 4. And that all happened in one horrible, very long weekend for me.
Well, when you were thinking about doing it, there was something in your mind that made you say, maybe not. Maybe here's the danger. What was that thing that made you what was the big obstacle that you were looking at to doing this big move?
I mean, the first big obstacle was just how much I cared about those people. Fortunately and unfortunately, every single one of those people I considered a very close friend. A lot of them were from Utah before we had made the move to San Francisco. And so that was really hard. And then the other thing was, I knew how it would look from an outsider's point of view. I knew what it would do to the reputation of the company, the people inside the company. I knew how much it would worry the investors to see that one of their portfolio companies just, you know, downsized so greatly. And that's just the way things goes. I knew it was for the good of the company, and there was no, you know, negative intentions, but I just knew how it would be perceived.
What about the risk that maybe some of these people are going to take your passwords and do bad things with them or get revenge somehow? You know, you're an early company. You must have given them a lot of access.
Yeah. I looking back, I think my co-founders must have taken care of that side of things a lot better. I myself, and I think my co-founders are always watching my back and helping protect me because they realize how naive and trusting I am. But I do. I run my life just 110% on trust. And so that didn't even cross my mind until you mentioned it just now.
Really?
Yeah.
You know what? One of the things that I was doing right now, you might have noticed my eyes move around the screen. I went to glassdoor.com and said, let me type in scan QR and see if anyone was upset. I don't see anything here. There's some companies that do that search. Ooh, it's painful.
Some of the people, they weren't upset when it happened. When that happened, they understood why. But some of them did realize, like, wow, they had a really good opportunity. Like, had they been maybe a little more proactive or, you know, whatever the circumstance, a lot of them saw the how cool of a situation they were in with Scan. And so since then, unfortunately, some of them had hard feelings, I think mostly towards me personally. But I understand where they're coming from and, like, why it is that way.
You know, the other thing that I looked up, everyone else who talked about you wrote about your Guinness Book record for Tetris. I'm such a cynic when it comes. I think it's because there's so many liars out there that we have to screen before they do this interview. And there's so many other interview programs that have liars on with their lies. And they're all excited about them. So what I've started doing now is just going to research all these little facts. But I couldn't find anything on Guinness Book of World Records about you. And it's not your fault. And I'll tell you why I know that it's not your fault. I went into the Guinness Book of World Records. It's guinnessworldrecords.com. I found the person who has whatever local, the most recent record I could find for Tetris. I typed their name into the search box at the top. That person didn't show up on the site. So it's Guinness's search that stinks. They need to check out Swift Type. I couldn't check anything out. I couldn't find out anything about it. What is this Tetris record?
So I was 13 years old, and I was playing for a club soccer team that we would do a lot of tournaments, you know, around the nation, which meant we had a lot of really long road trips. And I just got into Tetris, like obsessively got into Tetris. I honestly think, like, the way my mind works is very similar to whoever created Tetris, because everything, like, almost I could, like, seriously, like, play with my eyes closed. I got so obsessed with it. And anyways, I set a very high score, in my opinion, and my buddies were all freaking out about it, so they took pictures of it. And it basically, that was that. Until about a year later, one of my buddies bugged me to the point where we, like, submitted it to online. Anyways, in the mail, I get a certificate, you know, you are the world record holder. And I keep waiting out. So I go to the store, see the current book, look in the book. My name's not in it, but that was last year's. Then the next year's book comes out. I look in that book. I'm not in it. I contact them. They let me know that not every record makes it into the actual printed publication book. And so I basically let that be that. And anyway, so the only proof I would have is the picture taken of the actual Game Boy screen and the certificate. And unless my mom made that certificate and mailed it to ourselves, that would be the only proof I have as well.
So you come across as just this very casual person. In this interview, I think a lot of people are coming away with this feeling that either you're hiding something because you clearly have achieved a lot and we're not seeing the struggle, or saying this is a guy who just wants to, who's just an easygoing person, but underneath all the hard work is happening. I think and I'm trying to figure you out too. Here's what I think I figured out about you. You're just obsessive and comfortable with it. Or no, tenacious is the word, and comfortable with the whole process. I might be tenacious and I'm constantly uncomfortable. I'm tenacious. I will look up your Google World Records and I won't be comfortable in doing it. I'll go, God damn, I can't ever find, like, if there's a mistake here, I'm going to be so upset. This has to be the best interview ever. So I'm tenacious, but I'll have this inner energy. You might be the same way, but I think you'll have more fun with the process. Am I analyzing you right?
I would agree with that. So I think the positive side to the way I've done things is I enjoy the process. I don't let anything stress me too much. And it is fun. Like, it is naturally in me to obsess or be tenacious about things. That's the positive side of things. I love it. I love every part of my life, whether it be, you know, playing for my college soccer team, my family and friends inside of things, or the business. Like, I love every single part of it. One of the harder things that I have kind of struggled with, and I didn't really expect getting into this, is, and maybe you've seen the same thing, but there's kind of a lonely side to being this way, where seeing, like, how much hard work pays off and how much joy it brings me, I want that for other people. But when I'm, you know, up late at night alone, or if I, you know, just basically feeling like you care more about things than anybody else around you, it can kind of be disappointing or lonely. Yeah. And part of it is just because you feel lonely, and part of it is because you want, like, the goodness in your life for other people. And so that's been one of the harder things that I've just always struggled with.
I know what you mean. It's really, it stinks when you're the person who cares the most, and sometimes it feels like no one cares at all, which is not true. They just don't care as much as you do because it's impossible to care to this level.
Something, I don't, hopefully this isn't too much of a tangent, but I do a yearly trip to Tahiti, one of my favorite places on the planet. There's no service out there, so I have no choice but to disconnect. And I always make a point of bringing out really close friends or family with me. And a lot of people will say, you know, like, oh my gosh, you're so lucky you get to go on these trips to Tahiti. And my thought, I don't necessarily say this to them, but my thought is always the same. I say, why don't you do it? Why don't you care a little bit more about your life, work a little bit harder, and then enjoy it a little bit more, you know?
I know what you mean. You know what? There's so much else that I want to talk about. I think at some point we need to end it, so I'll end it here. The final thing that I will say is, cool new product that you guys are coming out with is Scan to Pay. Mm-hmm. I think I'd be a terrible interviewer here if I didn't let you say something about it, because I think that's one of the reasons why investors were so excited to partner with you. Am I right?
Yeah.
What is Scan to Pay?
So, I mean, you could call it a mobile wallet in a way. We store your personal or payment information within our app so that you can purchase a product or make a payment, any sort of transaction, by quickly and easily scanning a QR code. So you see a QR code, scan it, enter in your, you know, 4-digit PIN to confirm, and that quickly and easily you've made a payment without pulling out cash, without pulling out a credit card, you know, without any hardware being needed. A very cool new way to take or accept payments in an easier way. But to be honest, we purposely didn't brand it as a mobile wallet so far because of how kind of loud and noisy that is in the startup and the tech world right now. It was a lot easier for people to digest and download. Oh, this is a scanner. This is a QR code reader. Everybody could use one of those. I'm going to download it. If from the beginning we would have said, we're building a mobile wallet, but we're not quite there yet, then people would say, well, I might download you someday, but not quite yet, you know? So let's get in people's phones with something simple yet valuable and work our way towards something a lot more meaningful and powerful. That's kind of the outlook now. So right now, Scan to Pay is in beta. We're working with a lot of nonprofits and charities to see if, you know, we can increase their rate of donations by putting QR codes on their mailers, posters, flyers, wherever it is at their events, so that people can easily scan a QR code, select a donation amount, and that quickly and easily they've made that donation. So that's kind of the stage we're at right now, beta testing that with a few chosen charities and nonprofits.
I can see that. I can see walking into a store and just scanning a price tag and being able to pay right there by scanning that price tag. Or even in these interviews where I say, guys, if you like this interview and you want more, go to mixergpremium.com, sign up. We have hundreds of well-researched interviews with entrepreneurs who'll teach you how they built their businesses and help you build yours, inspiring stories that let you learn along the way. I could say all that. And then there'd be a QR code right on the screen. If they just hit the QR code, they could pay right away.
Yep, they don't need to fill out any form. They don't need to do anything. The app knows who they are. That quickly, it's done.
You've listened to my interviews. You now got to do one. What do you think now that you've seen it from both sides?
I think you're fantastic. I was really excited about this one because everything you've done is of high quality. But then also, I mean, it's been similar to what my experience was with Alexia. I think there's people who's mind kind of works in a similar, you know, wavelength or style as yours. And anyways, anytime you'd interview someone, you'd ask the question that was on the tip of my tongue. Like they would say something and I'd be like, oh, what about? And then you'd ask the question and I'd be like, perfect.
I love hearing that.
Chat with you.
Thank you. Check out the site scan.me to create your own QR code to download the app and to just check out the business and get a sense of how they did it and keep following them. I think we're going to see Garrett's name in the news a lot over the coming years. Just keep an eye out and see what he does and how he keeps grabbing the world's attention and growing his business. Garrett, thank you so much for being a part of it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you all. Bye.